Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Immigration and the economic realities thereof now that the president has spoken. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Thursday, the 20th of November. Good as always to have you with us, everybody. Well, that was a whole lot of buildup for a pretty quick speech, huh? It took about 15 minutes all in. As expected this evening, the president did announce his plan for immigration reform. That is, executive order immigration reform.
There are actions I have the legal authority to take as president. The same kinds of actions taken by Democratic and Republican presidents before me that will help make our immigration system more fair and more just.
President said he's going to work on securing the borders some more. He's going to make it easier and faster. That's a quote for highly skilled immigrants to stay here. And this, the topic of all the public debate.
So we're going to offer the following deal. If you've been in America for more than 5 years, if you have children who are American citizens or legal residents, if you register, pass a criminal background check, and you're willing to pay your fair share of taxes, you'll be able to apply to stay in this country temporarily without fear of deportation.
Work permits included for many of those people, and there was, of course, the obligatory legal caveat.
This deal does not apply to anyone who has come to this country recently. It does not apply to anyone who might come to America illegally in the future. It does not grant citizenship or the right to stay here permanently or offer the same benefits that citizens receive. Only Congress can do that.
So to get a little context on how the president's plans might affect some of the many various immigration constituencies in this country, we have called Barbara Hines. She is a clinical professor of law at the University of Texas School of Law. She is also the co-director of the immigration clinic there. And Emily Lamb. She is the vice president for federal issues at the Silicon Valley Leadership Group up in Silicon Valley. Welcome to you both.
Hello.
Hi.
Barbara, let me start with you. What do you think your clients, your constituents at the immigration clinic at the University of Texas will be thinking about the president's announcement tonight?
Well, I think many of them will be very pleased because this provision or the program that the president is announcing will allow that many of our clients will be able to come out of the shadows, as the president mentioned, and be able to get temporary status here.
Do you, Emily, attribute any blame here in the delay of this immigration process? It has been contentious for years. It is an issue certainly in Silicon Valley with high-tech and high-skilled immigrant laborers, workers. You've been waiting for this for a while.
Yeah, our companies have been advocating for immigration reform for over a decade, to the point where it's getting much harder to actually recruit and retain these high-skilled immigrants to our companies to hire them here. The environment was already very difficult, regardless of whether the president took executive orders. So there's still a lot of work to be done.
Mm-hmm. Barbara, on that topic of your constituents and perhaps their families now coming out of the shadows, where do you think they will go when they are out of the shadows? Will they stay in the jobs they have, do you think, or will they look for new employment?
Well, I think being able to come out of the shadows and get a work permit gives tremendous mobility to an immigration population. So it's hard to know what each individual will do, but obviously having a work permit allows labor mobility, which means that immigrants may get higher paying jobs. That means that they'll be able to contribute more to our economy. They'll be able to pay taxes. And so I think it's a real plus for our society and for our economy.
Talk to me for a second about the pushback factor, Barbara. As you know, Republicans in the House and Senate are not pleased that the president has done this. There's a lot that's being talked about. Do you think in the new Congress things will happen to change what the president has done tonight?
Well, hopefully not, because I think what the president has done is legal. And as President Obama mentioned in his speech, there's broad authority under immigration laws to set priorities, to decide what enforcement priority should be, who should be deported and who shouldn't. So regardless of what the Republicans may talk about, I think it will be difficult to say that what the president has done is not legal.
Emily Lamb, same basic question to you. It's obviously a different economic force that you're dealing with in Silicon Valley, but what's the anticipation of what's going to happen come January?
We are worried that this will hurt the environment in D.C. since there's already so much gridlock. But the need for immigration reform, both from an economic and moral perspective, is still there. The provisions that were released help a little bit, but fundamentally we need a legislative fix to increase H-1B and green cards. And without that, our companies will still struggle to hire the talent they need.
Barbara Hines is a clinical professor at the University of Texas Law School. She is the co-director of the immigration clinic there. Emily Lamb is the vice president for federal issues at the Silicon Valley Leadership Group in Silicon Valley. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Thank you.
There are, according to the good people at the Pew Research Center, 11.2 million undocumented people in this country. 3.5 or 4 million will be eligible for work under tonight's announcement. That is in a labor force, it has to be pointed out, of something near 150 million people or more. So how much, you know, is that actually going to change things in the American economy? From Washington Marketplace's Scott Tong has that story.
Workers without papers make up 5% or so of our labor force. It's a varied group, but large numbers of them are renters, they speak English poorly, and get by on about $18,000 a year. Job-wise, Audrey Singer at the Brookings Institution says they tend to work
in the hospitality industry, in construction, and in places with agriculture. They're in farm jobs as well.
So what happens if and when many of them receive permits to work legally? The Migration Policy Institute figures it could affect 3.7 million people, freeing them to chase better jobs. Here's the Institute's Mark Rosenblum.
As people get legal status, they're going to be more mobile. You know, there are some unauthorized immigrants who are unable to change jobs because they don't have proof of work eligibility. It's difficult to quit a job and look for another one.
It may not be a large-scale shakeup, though. In a study of people who got new green cards, the only people who moved up the wage ladder had high skills. Less than one in five do, says Laura Hill of the Public Policy Institute of California.
It was really the high-skill workers who were able to translate this new status into better-paying jobs. The lower-skilled unauthorized workers, which are the majority, were not able to make that transition in the amount of time that we were observing them.
If that's an indication, only those with good skills in English may be emboldened by work papers. And it may be temporary. We're talking executive order, which means the next White House executive could push the undo button. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Wall Street today was up. Not crazy up, though, just up. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Right at the top of the list that consumers think about, there is, of course, price. There's quality as well. But we are all, that is, those of us who buy stuff, increasingly worried about privacy. And that worry has created a whole nother level of stuff for us to buy, because privacy is now big business in and of itself. Ben Johnson is the host of Marketplace Tech. He had a story about all that in the New York Times this week. It's part of our collaboration, which was called A Guide to Buying Just About Anything. Hey, Ben.
Hi, Kai.
Let me get right to it then, man. Here we are late in 2014. The digital age is well on its way. Can I buy myself online privacy?
Well, you can upgrade it, okay? let's talk a little bit about your online data profile. Right. That's the like real simple stuff. It's the kind of information we once found in, I don't know, the phone book,
phone
right?
Book, yeah.
Your name, your phone number, your address. But there's also more detailed stuff, things like I won't cast aspersions, but one's criminal record, if they have one, a mugshot.
I do not. Thank you. I do not. But let's say I did, just for argument's sake.
Sure.
My clean track record notwithstanding. What do I do if I want that not to be out there anymore?
Well, you probably heard about this right to be forgotten law over in Europe.
Yeah. Yep.
So it's this new law that allows users to request certain links in search results can be taken down, and they are being taken down. But over here in the U.S., it's way more difficult to make that kind of thing happen. One reason, the First Amendment, right?
Yeah, of course.
There are a few ways you can prove copyright violation, libel, something else that's sort of beyond the shadow of a doubt. But really, the First Amendment makes it hard. An increasing number of services, basically, they'll promise you, give them $100, $200 a year, and they will go to some of these sites that post your information and ask them nicely and persistently to take it down. But at the end of the day, if you really want to protect your privacy, you kind of have to protect it out of the gate.
Yeah, and this is the upgrade thing you're talking about, right? If I've got a Facebook profile or Twitter or I'm out there, really in any sense of the word, it's almost too late.
It is almost too late. Now, the interesting thing is, think about Snapchat, right? It's
right.
this pop version of this application that promises not as just, you know, a side feature, but as the main feature that it will erase your data for you. There are a couple of other apps that have popped up. Whisper is one. Canary is another. They're promising this is a key feature. Data privacy, I think, is really having its moment right now. And that's what's interesting. Technology companies, big and small, are responding to this. Apple and Google are adding security features to their software, hardware. Law enforcement's actually not super happy about that. Mm-hmm. Tech companies, though, are doing it anyway because users seem to increasingly want this kind of protection.
There is a consumer behavior part of this thing, though, right? Because for a long time, the internet was all about, you know, Web 2.0 and Facebook and all that stuff. It was all about sharing and getting out there. And it seems like we, that is the consumer public, has said, whoa, wait, no, hold on. Now that we know exactly what you're doing with all this stuff, we've changed our minds. And there's a whole big genie back in the bottle dilemma going on here.
There really is. And Kai, you know, I mean, the internet's been around, we could say, you know, 20, 25 years now, right? And people are really starting to realize that your most public and your most permanent record in some ways exists on the internet. And people are starting to think about that. I talked to a venture capitalist a few days ago who told me that he tells his son, don't put anything on the internet that you don't want to live there forever. And he's, you know, imagining that this space is really going to grow.
Ben Johnson is the host of Marketplace Tech. His story about trying to buy some privacy back was in our New York Times collaboration this week. It was called A Guide to Buying Just About Anything. It's online, of course, and in the paper yesterday, if you see a copy lying around. Ben, thanks a bunch.
Thank you, Kat.
Coming up.
The food is like way better in the cafeteria on Thursdays.
That was true when I was a kid, too. We'll tell you why. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 33 points today. 0.2% ended at 17,719, did the blue chips. The Nasdaq hiked 26 points, about 0.5%, 4,701, 4701. The S&P 500 up 4 points, 0.2%, 2,052. Everybody seemed to want a taste of Habit restaurants today. The burger chain made its debut as a publicly traded company, ended up a sizzling 119%. Dollar Tree leapt more than 5% after it raised its sales outlook for the year. Best Buy rang up a nearly 7% gain after its profits beat estimates. General Motors slipped less than 0.1% today on news the state of Arizona has sued the car company over delayed recalls. That's the ignition thing. Banks Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, and J.P. Morgan got a grilling on Capitol Hill today. Senators questioned officials about whether they had used practices that inflated prices and curbed demand for aluminum and other commodities. Morgan Stanley off 0.25%. J.P. Morgan drifted, rather, 0.75% lower. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note off to 2.33%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. Getting into the holiday swing, the Capitol Christmas tree arrives in Washington. It's been making its way from Minnesota, where it was harvested. On November 21st, 1980, fans of TV's Dallas the world over tuned in to find out who shot JR. It was that scheming Kristen Shepherd, of course. And speaking of TV, the United Nations marks World Television Day. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. In education news today, higher education to be precise, the University of California is about to get a whole lot more expensive. After a three-year freeze on tuition, the UC Board of Regents has approved a plan to raise prices by as much as 5% a year for the next 5 years. That would ultimately
put tuition well past $15,000 a year. UC President Janet Napolitano says state funding just hasn't kept up with cost, and that is a phenomenon that is happening all over the country. From the Education Desk at WYPR, Marketplace's Amy Scott reports.
10 years ago, the state of California covered about 60% of a UC student's tuition. Families were on the hook for about 40%. Now it's 60-40 the other way.
In the last decade, tuition has doubled for California students.
That's Michelle Siqueiros, president of the Campaign for College Opportunity. She says there's good reason for taxpayers to invest more in higher education.
Because college-educated Californians earn more money, pay more taxes, and use less of the social service costs that the state has to spend.
After years of steep cuts, the state has increased funding for higher ed in the last few years. But according to the university, not enough to keep up with growing demand for a college education. John Douglas is a senior fellow at the Center for Studies in Higher Education at UC Berkeley. He says all over the country, as states face higher health care and pension costs, there's less money to go around.
The legislators and governors are making lots of choices as to, well, how much can we really invest in higher ed when we have all these other obligations.
Most states have started restoring some of the deep cuts made during the recession, says Andy Carlson. He's with the State Higher Education Executive Officers Association.
The recovery is definitely happening at a much slower pace, and there's certainly continued budget pressures.
Consumer advocates worry that could make college less accessible for low-income and middle-class students. But in California, so far, extra financial aid has kept costs for those families roughly the same. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
If you're a regular user of the Firefox web browser, the way you search for pretty much anything, I don't know, the nearest deep dish pizza or the highest rated dry cleaner in your neighborhood, is about to change. Mozilla, the nonprofit that owns Firefox, has announced plans to change its default search engine from Google to Yahoo, although just for users here in the United States, I should note. Google was paying Mozilla $300 million a year for the privilege of being its default search engine, but other than that, what difference does being a default search engine really make? Marketplace's David Weinberg has that story.
Mozilla and Google are very different companies. Mozilla is a mission-driven nonprofit, for starters. It's built on 10 principles, one of which is that individuals' security and privacy are fundamental and must not be treated as optional. Google has a slightly different take on privacy.
Google, of course, is in the business of tracking users, and Firefox has taken a very strong line on giving users the ability to not be tracked.
Ellis Horowitz is a professor of computer science at the University of Southern California. Yahoo has agreed to honor Mozilla's Do Not Track policy. In return, Yahoo gets all of Firefox's default search traffic, and it gets some street cred with users who are concerned about their privacy. Just how much Yahoo is paying for the traffic and the street cred hasn't been made public. And as for Google, it ultimately isn't losing a whole lot.
Of course, many people just have the Google homepage as their default page, so they don't really need the search engine to do their searching.
Plus, Google has its own competing browser, Chrome, which now has a much larger market share than Firefox's. And as more and more web traffic shifts to mobile phones, Firefox has created its own mobile operating system.
The Firefox OS, which they call it, they're getting onto low-cost phones around the world.
Liz Gaines is a senior editor with the online tech site Recode.
Mozilla, in some sense, has already kind of moved on from the Firefox battle in that they're trying to take on the next big closed platform, which is mobile.
I'm David Weinberg for Marketplace.
School lunchrooms are sometimes called the biggest restaurant chain in America. In districts across California, there is a program aimed at getting those cafeterias serving more local ingredients, part of a big push here to promote healthy eating and local agriculture. There are, though, a couple of questions, like how will schools pay for it and will California kids eat it? Youth Radio's Maya Escobar reports.
California public schools serve 560 million lunches a year. And in a place that also grows a lot of this country's food, it makes sense that we, California kids, would eat California meals. That's the idea behind a new school lunch plan called California Thursdays. 15 districts across the state have partnered with the program, including the biggest, like Los Angeles and San Diego. To roll out a plan of that scale, you probably have to start small.
What we like to call a bite-sized implementation strategy.
Zenobia Barlow is the co-founder of the Center for Eco-Literacy. For the past 20 years, her organization has been promoting sustainable living through schools. Because school lunch is so big, Barlow says it could change the way we eat, outside the cafeteria too.
By institutional purchasing, we're going to trigger demand that will result in greater production of sustainably grown and sustainably produced food. So just from a business perspective, when kids start eating fresh and freshly prepared delicious meals, there are economies of scale that make it possible.
But school lunch is bound by federal requirements and a strict budget. Alexandra Emmett is part of the nutrition team at the Oakland Unified School District. She actually has the title, farm-to-school supervisor.
For an entree, which needs to be a serving of protein and a serving of grain, we have a budget of 60 cents per entree. For the fruit or vegetable, we have a budget of 20 cents. For the milk, it's 25 cents.
But a California Thursdays dish can cost more. For example, Emmett says the district pays 40 cents for a locally sourced, antibiotic-free chicken leg. High schoolers need two drumsticks to meet USDA protein requirements, which puts the entree over budget. So sometimes, the district balances the extra costs over the course of the lunch calendar. Or, it reaches the mark by replacing a second piece of chicken with, say, red beans and rice. It involves some creativity, but Emmett says this type of thinking is starting to catch on.
I talk to folks in Maine, you know, who are sourcing local proteins up there, even fish, that kind of thing. You know, so there's districts all across the country who are starting to do this.
Just last month, Minnesota Thursdays launched its own local lunch program for kids in the Twin Cities. But back in Oakland,
the food is, like, way better in the cafeteria on Thursdays.
Ayana Edgerly is 17. She worked with the Center for Eco-Literacy to conduct peer taste tests on the California Thursdays recipes, asking students to score the dishes.
Rate 1 through 5, what would you rate this dish in taste, in appearance, and would you get in the lunch line? Will this dish get you in the lunch line?
Me personally, I haven't eaten a school lunch since the 4th grade, but my colleagues at Youth Radio offered to prepare one of the new dishes.
The chicken's, like, shredded on top of the brown rice, which is, like, on the bottom, and then there's broccoli, like, little broccoli trees all over. It looks kind of cute. It's actually pretty good. It's like a home-cooked meal, except that at school.
Soon, we'll see if more kids feel the same. In Oakland, California, I'm Maya Escobar for Marketplace.
Maya's story was produced for us by Youth Radio. There have been, in the whole history of ever, just 12 people who've won an Emmy, a Grammy, an Oscar, and a Tony Award in their careers. Mike Nichols was one of them. The legendary writer, producer, and director died last night at the age of 83. On the big screen, he directed The Graduate, Working Girl, and Charlie Wilson's War, among others. He produced Angels in America for HBO, and he won 9 Tony Awards in all, the last of which was in 2012 for Death of a Salesman. We had Mike Nichols on this program as that show was getting ready to open on Broadway. And as we were talking, he said that there were two plays in his life that really stuck with him. One was A Streetcar Named Desire. The other was Death of a Salesman. But Salesman, he said, was really special.
Streetcar, after some time, no longer seemed to be about now at all. There are no Blanches anymore. But there are Willies.
But Salesman is, yeah. So it was central to your life. Can we say it's central to these times as well?
It seems to be. I think that's exactly right. I think in a strange way, it's truer of now the way Orwellian thought is truer now. You know, de Tocqueville saw ahead. He predicted this in 1840, for Christ's sake. That sentence of his, that if American democracy continues in the way in which it's going, it'll become eventually pure market forces. I think of that every week. We are pure market forces. It's happened. And, of course, that's what salesman is about. We're all salesmen now.
Mike Nichols, who's 83.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note on the way out today, if you want to know A, why net neutrality is such a big deal, and B, why in part your home internet bill might be so high. The latest figures from the Canadian networking company Sandvine show that Netflix, all by its lonesome, accounts for 35% of everything that is on the internet, 35% of all the bandwidth used in peak periods ever on the internet, which means mostly at night, of course, when we're home watching stuff. The next closest user, just for that all-important context again, YouTube, at just 14% of capacity. So there you go. All right, we're out of here. The Dow up 33 points today, about 0.2%. The NASDAQ up 26 points, 0.5%. The S&P 500 popped up 4 points, 0.2%. Ben Adair, John Buckley, Patty Hirsch, Cindy Johnston, George Judson, Dave Shaw, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. Our managing editor is Mark Miller. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.